Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to, hopefully enjoy. Thanks a lot for all the good feedback, some really great feedback recently from some recent shows that I've done. Lots of people enjoyed the review of The Stand that I did, and what was the other one? Red Shirt. A great way to give feedback, not just so I can look at it, is actually if you go to the blog post of each one of these podcasts in the podcast feed, if you're sfbrp.com, or if you check out the episodes list, if you're going back through other episodes, just check that out there also at sfbrp.com. You can click on the Goodreads link and there it'll take you to my review on Goodreads.com. And of course, my review of each book on Goodreads.com is just sort of like a mention saying, hey, check out the full review on my podcast. But what you can often find there is other people, other listeners' comments about this podcast that you're listening to. And so not only on Goodreads.com can you find all the updates that I put on the website, that, you know, I do sort of like these status updates of as I'm reading them, and people comment there as well. But of course, you can actually comment back to me and to other people about my full review. An interesting comment which came up was after my long ranting review of Red Shirts, where I talk about, you know, where I think it was this, you know, all my the ideas that I put in like the coda of my podcast review. Someone just came and said, no, there was an interview with Skulls, and he just said he was just trying to write a fun book and wanted to be slightly more serious with the codas at the end. So all of my literary theory ideas of being a book about meta-ness, and it is a book about meta-ness, but I think I took it a few more steps than Skulls actually did. But you know, there's some really great feedback on these reviews and on the books themselves. And of course, if you're a member of Goodreads.com, I can see what you think about books even before I've read them. So keep sending in your feedback that way. And of course, emails. I reply to every email, luke@juggler.net, if you want to get in contact or recommend any book or anything like that. So straight on to today's review. I'm currently traveling, and then I'm going to Italy for a week with my girlfriend and her parents, and I think the place we're staying doesn't have internet access, so I'm not quite sure when I'll update this, but or upload this, but hopefully you get to listen to this soon. Of course, you're listening to it now, but hopefully I get to upload it soon. So this book, I actually started it 2 days ago, finished it yesterday, and I'm reviewing it today. So it's quite a compressed schedule compared to how I normally read and review books. I normally think about the books a bit longer after doing the reading. But this is a brisk book, and not a huge amount to talk about, so I'll just get on with it. So this book is called The Alloy of Law by Brandon Sanderson, and you may be thinking, hey, wait a second, didn't Luke just read a Brandon Sanderson book, The Way of Kings? And I did, and that was a massive chunky book. It actually happens that I'd actually downloaded this from Audible. I'm not quite sure when it came out. I don't have any information about the book open in front of me, but I think it only came out this year. And I downloaded it, and then I was in, so I had it on my iPod all the time. And then I was in a bookshop and saw The Way of Kings, and I was like, oh, I'll get that instead. Oh, I'll get that as well and just read that. And I did and enjoyed it. And then because I kind of ran out of podcasts, I was looking through and said, oh, there's another Brandon Sanderson novel here. It's pretty short. It was only like 10 hours long or 11 hours long or something like that, which is very short for him. And I'd heard it's quite a brisk read. It's not as in-depth as any of his other novels. And boy, is it not in-depth at all compared to his other novels, which are normally these massive, great, chunky 600-page novels, or even The Way of Kings, which is like over 1,000 pages long. It was great to just be able to put this on one day when I was walking around Italy. I went to Napoli and Pompeii, and I was just walking around listening to this. And then yesterday, as I was hanging out in the hot tub on the cruise ship that I was working on, that I am working on, hard work, I finished the book off there while hanging out in the sun, which was, again, pretty good. So it's a standalone novel and a short read. Let's have a look at some notes here. Yeah, so it's set in the same world as a previous fantasy series of his called Mistborn, and that's a three-book series. And I know this from listening to Brandon Sanderson on his podcast, on his Writing Excuses podcast, where him and some other guys are talking about this, and you kind of pick up from them talking about their writing what kind of stuff is in their books. And he's mentioned before that this is going to be like a trilogy of trilogies. So he's writing three books about it, sort of set in like this Renaissance kind of fantasy world, like more medieval, very late medieval kind of Renaissance kind of period. That'll be a trilogy there. And then a trilogy set in the modern world, which would be more urban fantasy. And then another trilogy set in the future, which will be science fiction, but all of them being told with the same magic system, and how this magic system, you know, saves the world, or, you know, how people who can use this magic does this and that and saves the world. And it sounds like an interesting project, but the Alloy of Law is kind of a little sort of side project, like set in the same universe, but like halfway between the like the 300 years ago, or the however many it is, like 500 years ago, Renaissance kind of fantasy. More medieval fantasy and sort of like the modern 21st century, you know, urban fantasy kind of thing that he's wanting to do. This is set around about 300 years after his Mistborn trilogy. And it's much more of a you know, it starts off and it's more Wild West, and then all the action then heads back into kind of an industrial London, because it's a bit like London with all the railways and canal system, and then being replaced by railways. So, you know, it's like a British industrial city which had canals and then is being taken up by railways, but also a little bit more like New York, because they're talking about skyscrapers. So a lot of the action takes place in there, where in among the city and the skyscrapers, and then there's a factory districts, and then they head out and they're out in the wilds again and they come back, so they can get around on horses if they want, and trains if they want. Electricity is just about coming in, and there's automobiles, but it's a lot of steampunk kind of things going on. And the way I'm actually describing it now, so imagine Wild West, like Wild West sensibilities set in industrial London / New York, with trains, canals, automobiles, and early electricity, and gas powered this and gas powered that, and candles and things. I'm not just using these shortcuts to like get across this world building really quickly. This is actually what Brandon Sanderson does. Instead of him doing these elaborate descriptions of cities and monsters, and this is the magic system that spans the entire world, and over here's this country, and over here's this country, and over here's this, and you know, he does this, especially in the of Kings. He's setting up this world which is going to be, he's going to be investing in and look like living in for the next, you know, 10 books in this massive cycle, this epic cycle. Here he doesn't have to do that. He can just go, look, imagine Wild West, industrial London, skyscrapers, blah blah blah, industrial revolution, scientific revolution, go. And you're just like, okay. And he's like, there's no monsters, don't need to worry about that. This is not a book about saving the world. This is not a massive scale epic book or anything like that. It's very much, we're just doing this, you know, we're just telling this much more like adventure-y kind of mystery story going on here. But of course, the magic does exist in the background. And what I think is really interesting about, I'll talk about the magic here. Normally I'd talk about it later in a fantasy, but I might as well talk about it here. Because what happens is that this scientific and industrial revolution, which is going on at this time, I think fits very, very well with Brandon Sanderson's very technically minded magic system. And I always think this is, like, for me, it's a criticism of some of his magic that it is, like, so well worked out. It's like, okay, he takes away the mystery from the magic. He even takes away the magic. It feels like it's science fiction where he's setting rules and then people doing stuff within the rules rather than using magic to break out of the rules. And I know that's a very, maybe a shallow way of looking at the difference between science fiction and fantasy, but I do find his fantasy quite scientific. And The Way of Kings was different from that because he does go a bit more into like the mystical, wondrous stuff. But I think it's just because, like, in his head, all of the magic's worked out. It's just because it's so elaborate in that novel and there's so many ways he can take it, it's still, you know, he's still got a, you know, it, he didn't just, it, it's more mysterious, not because he doesn't know it all, but because he didn't convey it all. But in Mistborn, I found that I felt like everything had already been worked out, like all of the rules were already known, and if they weren't, we knew them by the end of the book. Whereas here, it doesn't matter that everybody always, everybody at the beginning of the book totally understands how all of the magic works, and says, oh yes, there's, it uses the same magic system, of course, as Mistborn, and there was this thing called Allomancy, where there was these 8 different kinds of powers that different magic, you know, different kind of magics that you could do if you ingested and kind of burnt in your stomach some kind of different metal. So iron does this, and steel does that, and copper does this, and gold does that, and you know, and you get these different powers. And then there was this other kind of magic system which was like kind of similar but different as well, and that was called ferrochemistry or ferrochemy or whatever it was. And there's sort of like another 8 metals with another 8 powers there as well. And there was in Mistborn, the Mistborn that they're talking about are the people who have all 8 of, they have the full set of magic powers. Other people just have one kind of magic power, but these have the whole eight set, or set of eight. And then in An Ally of Lore, which is set later, and it's kind of referencing back to the events of Mistborn, the trilogy. I only read the first book in the Mistborn trilogy because I heard the second two books weren't that good. So I read that first book, and then skipping forward 300 years, these characters have still got, you know, they're still being mentioned in the, you know, in the modern culture, which is, you know, in this more steampunky kind of culture. But they've become like mythical figures, mythical beings, and kind of religious figures as well. They obviously set up their own followings, and some people follow, I can't remember the names of them now, but one of them is the is called Harmony, and another one's called Old Iron Eyes, and you know, Iron Eyes. And yeah, there's these different things, and but it seems like the magic has been restricted quite a lot. It used to be that you get these Mistborn who had eight different magic powers, and they could do this and do that and do this and do that, and it seems to be much more like, oh well, if they can't get a hold of this metal, they can't do it anymore. You know, they can't use that metal anymore. So there was these very precious metals, and now it seems like the restriction of metal has gone. It's like, okay, it doesn't matter, you know, what they have. It's still really easy to get all these metals because it feels like the world has been explored a lot more, and the industrial mining has come online. So it's not the magic, but the people have far fewer of these powers. There aren't any Mistborn. There's these things called Twinborn, which have one Allomancy power and one Ferrochemistry power each. And some people just have one or the other, but the most powerful kind of magic people only have two powers. And I think in this entire book, there's only like five or six different magical powers which are explored. There's the guy who's a pusher, who can push against metal himself, or like fly with the thing. I can't remember what it's called. Coin shots, because they flick up coins and push them around. And then you got the puller people who can pull metal to them, and you get the healer and who can heal himself, and then you get the kind of person who can slow down time in a bubble around him, and then the other ones who can speed up time in a bubble around them. And apart from that, I think that's it. So what happens is you get much less rambling kind of magical system which can be explored in this scientific industrial revolution in a much more scientific way. Which is, I think, works really well, because it doesn't feel like I want it to be a fantasy with a sense of mystery. It's like, no, that's not it. There's these very few people who either work outside the law or inside the law with these magical powers, and let's go. So because we get like this, you know, flying through the air, Matrix-like leaps and jumps, and we get this, you get the main guy, Waxelium, who is this, he can adjust his own weight, that's it. So he can make himself weigh more and weigh less. And he also is a pusher, so he can make himself weigh a lot and then push against something, and he stays where he is and the other stuff flies away. Or he can make himself really light and push against something and fly through the air really well. So you get that kind of, you know, Matrix-like leaps that he can do in defying gravity. And you get, like, he can push and pull on bullets. So when he shoots, he doesn't miss, because as he shoots, he can somehow sense the bullet going through the air, and by pushing it slightly, he can make sure it goes exactly on target. Even if his hand is wobbling a bit, he can make sure it goes exactly where he wants it to go. So he can kind of curve bullets like that, go through the air. He can throw a bullet and then curve it onto target. A bit like, you know, the movie Wanted with James McAvoy and Lara Croft. I don't watch the movie. It's really not worth watching, but they do the kind of curving bullets. Actually, like the first 40 minutes of that movie is actually really good fun, and then it's just stupid and pathetic. But they do this curving bullets kind of thing, and that's the kind of thing they got in here. And also, there's this really interesting thing where, as the main characters are fighting, one of them suddenly pops up his little "I'm slowing down time in a bubble around me" magical power, and it becomes a bit like, you know, and again, a bit like the Matrix, where you can slow down time. It's like, and they go, oh, and they go outside of time. But it reminded me a lot of the Sherlock Holmes movie, where he kind of, like, it, like, the time slows down, and you get, like, the internal monologue of Sherlock Holmes going, now, if he's going to go around there, I'm going to come here, and I'm going to punch him on the side of the head there. And then, because I know how he fights, and he uses his intellect to be able to work himself out of, you know, fight sequences and action sequences. And that's what you get here in this book, which I found really interesting about, like, this magic thingy going on here. these fight, magic fight sequences, is that they can just go, wait, okay, right, okay, let's calm down. Okay, look over there, there's a guy over there with a gun, and there's a guy over there with a gun, and so, like, I'll run around there, and you jump in this way, and we'll do it. And then the two characters go, deal, high five each other, take down the time bubble, and rush off and go and do their things. And it might feel a bit weird that I'm actually referencing a lot of movies, action movies here, with the pushing and pulling of bullets, and the Matrix leaping, and the Sherlock Holmes time slowing fighting and all these other things, but that's what this book really feels like, and it's a very action heavy book, and that's why I think this really this book really works a lot, is because you've got a setting, this steampunky industrial revolution like late 19th century kind of setting, or maybe early 20th century, but I'm not quite sure where it's meant to be. You've got the Wild West fighting, and you've got like the magical fighting going on, and they really do complement each other a lot. And also, let me just point out this plot hole. Well, it's not so much a plot hole, it's just that I think at some point Brandon Sanderson, he kind of pulled his punches a bit. He got this idea, there's this character called Wayne, and he's the one who can slow time in a bubble around him, so everybody else around him, what does he do? He speeds up his own time, or he slows down. Yeah, so he speeds up his own time. So the rest of the world slows down, and then he can carry on. But because we always see this from inside the bubble, we can see what he's going. But he, for a quite, like, seemingly arbitrary plot reason, it's not really arbitrary, but for a plot reason, he doesn't like shooting people. He's like, oh, I shot a guy once, and it was the wrong guy, and he had a family, and I'm never going to shoot anyone again. So he fights with sticks, these dueling sticks, where he can beat people up. And I realized, I was like, I kept thinking, well, why doesn't he just shoot people? Because he's got he's the main guy. And there's this scene where there's lots of people around them and they're planning. It's like, okay, there's these 30 people or these 40 people or whatever it is, and we need to kill as many of them as we can. How are we going to do this? And I was like, okay, one of you's a really good shot. And if you just give the other guy, you know, like, both take guns, have this time bubble around you, pick out a good target, aim, drop the bubble, both shoot, put the bubble back. Oh yeah, because if you shoot out of a bubble, it means that the bullet flies off in a weird way. You can't aim correctly. There's this kind of quantum uncertainty at the edge of the bubble, so you can't shoot through it. Anything going out kind of gets a weird spin, a weird different direction on it. So it's like, okay, aim, drop the bubble, shoot once, shoot twice, bang, bang, drop two people, put the bubble back up. And then you can see who noticed you when you shot, and aim at someone else, drop the bubble, bang, bang, bring the bubble back. And you could just keep doing that. And I realized, and this is what I was thinking, I was like, just do this. And I was like, why is he fighting with sticks? Why don't they just do, like it would be like in a computer game where you can pause the game. Right, work out what I was going to do. Okay, aim over here, unpause the action, shoot, shoot, bang, pause the action. You know, you can do that. And they don't do that. He doesn't do that in this book. And that's why he fights. I think that must be the only reason he fights with sticks. So I wish they could. Maybe there was a bit of better writing that could have been done there, but I'm not quite sure. Anyway, moving on to the story, away from the magic-y world-building stuff. So there's a guy called Wax, or Waxillium, and he is a guy. He's like this hired gun, this lawman out in the Wild West, and he goes into this deserted mining town and takes on a thing, but you kind of realize this is just going to be, I think it even says it's just the prologue, and he's got a letter with him, and it turns out that his uncle and his cousin and his sister and his auntie have all died, and he is now the only one left in his family. And it turns out that he is a royal, not a royal family member, but like he's an earl or a duke or something like that. And he's got to go back and run the family in high society. And I was like, oh, because he gets back and he's not enjoying it. And I was like, it's all going to be about him fitting in with royalty and fitting in with the earls and the counts and the viscounts and the duchies and all of this kind of stuff. And that was the thing that I like least about Brandon Sanderson, that is so much about royal courts and stuff. And I was like, well, I'm not really interested about, you know, royalty. That's not what interests me. And I like the action. I like all these other things that he does, and the magic and the world building and stuff. But so much of it seems to be about this court politics, which I'm not really interested in, or not the way that he does it. And I was thinking, oh, it's going to be about that. And then there's this, you know, he has to find himself a wife and make himself respectable and fit in and get his, you know, his house, which is, his house business, which is kind of crumbling. He's got to get that back on track and look after all his workers and look after his lands. And then there's this character comes in who's like his prospective wife, And she's all cold-hearted, and she's like, well, in the contract that we'll sign to make sure we're married and stuff, we'll do this and we'll do that. And then, like, but she comes in with the obvious love interest, which is the shy cousin. I'm like, well, she's obviously the love interest. And then I was like, oh, I don't really want it to be about, you know, him going with this woman and having to have this weird love triangle and stuff like that. And then, like, during the course of that, you're suddenly like, it's nothing about that. It's actually going to be about a train robbery and a Wild West sheriff who used to be out in the wilds, but now he lives in the big city, and he's got to catch the train robbers and solve the crime and rescue the maidens across the city and outside the city and stuff like that. So once I actually realized the direction that it was going to go, which you can kind of tell by the front cover, which is a guy in a bowler hat with a six shooter. It really is steampunk Matrix gunfights and it's like, well, what's not to like about that? And then once the main story starts, which actually starts with this meeting, prospective wife material, who turns up. Once the main story begins, all of the action takes place over about 3 days. It's taken about a year, but it's like the prologue, and then a few months later is another one, and then another 10 months later, 8 months later is another scene. But once you get to that third main scene, it's really like the rest of the action takes place over like 3 days or something. Something happens, then there's another night. Yeah, so like over 3 nights, like 3 days and 3 nights. And as you go along, of course, it picks up and picks up and picks up, and it, you know, it accelerates through. I'm not talking that time accelerates or anything like that. I'm talking like the plot accelerates. And as he goes through, he finds more layers of motivations for the bad guys. And of course, there's some conspiracy going on in the background. And, you know, and Waxillium, he kind of peels it back bit by bit. And he's dealing with his guilt and stuff like that. But and there's a bit of a will they won't they vibe between him and the cute cousin, the student girl who turns up as well. And there are a few plot holes. There's a few timing issues where I'm thinking, okay, well, they killed all the bad guys, and suddenly there's lots more of the bad guys. And they were saying recruitment's hard, but they seem to manage to restock all of the cannon fodder, restock all the red shirts again. Well, cannon fodder before the next big action sequence to give the guys more people to kill. And so, well, I thought they got rid of all these. And then there's another thing that they like. Someone says, oh, here's the plan. You've got to build this, and you're like, really? They did that in a day? They built that in a day, or was it already done? Because they kind of hint that that thing had already been built. But I'm thinking, if they're going to build this big kind of steampunk contraption, it's like, unless you've got like modern, well, I don't know how it would work out, but it just seemed a bit too. It just some of the things seemed a bit too. For both sides, actually, sometimes it felt a bit too convenient for the bad guys to suddenly be able to go, oh no, we can just restock up on people that we got to kill and that kind of stuff. But the ending I found very satisfying, because I realized that there was what you thought it was, just train robbery, blah blah blah. It was always hinted that something bigger was going on. However, it was never set up like Brandon Sanderson's other novels that I've read, which are all these more epics level fantasies, where every time it's gonna be the end of the world, or it's sort of setting up for this ponderous, you know, earth shattering battle at the end, where it's gonna end in a big battle and the world is gonna change and the government's gonna be overthrown and the gods themselves are gonna come back from the dead and the gods, you know, it didn't feel like anything quite like that all the way through. It set up like, once they kill the bad guy, rescue the maiden, work out who was stealing the stuff from the trains, I thought, that'll be it. And there was more behind it than that. And there was some other twists. Like I say, once they peel away back through some of these, you know, what the bad guys are wanting, and you realise there's sort of like this coalition of bad guys, and each one of them wants something different, and you're wondering, well, how is this guy using this one, and how is this guy using that one? So it's way less complex than a clunky, chunky Sanderson plotting. Although I don't think he does that clunky of plots, but there's always seems to be too much in there. And yeah, I always think, why can he just like tone down the world building and tone down the magic and tone down everything and just have like a smart short plot? And that's what he does in here. And it feels much more like, to bring it back to the movies, it feels much more like, you know, like an 80-minute action movie with, you know, stock character, or maybe like even a TV show. I'm thinking something like yeah, sort of like a steampunky, like Firefly kind of thing, where you get the guy who can shoot well and goes in, and they either do a train robbery or they that's even a Firefly episode, isn't it? The second one is the train robbery. Anyway, so there's either, you know, they're doing this or not doing this, or they're good. Sometimes they're the good guys, sometimes they're the bad guys. You're never quite sure. It feels much more like that rather than say something like Mistborn or what was the other one? Warbreaker or Way of Kings or Elantris, all of which I've read. They feel much more like a full-blown movie, or even like a series of movies, like a trilogy of movies brought into one novel with that. It's that wide-ranging, and this just isn't it. So restricting the scope, restricting the plot, restricting the cast of characters, restricting the magic, restricting the setting, really brings it down to a much denser, well, not denser book, because I think it's less dense than the other ones in many ways, but it's just for me it was a lot more enjoyable. Also, knowing that this isn't in the main Mistborn trilogy of trilogies story arc, he's going to do three in this time period, then three in that time period, and then three in another time period. This one feels like he can't tell a big world-changing story now, because this feels much more like an ongoing TV show where at the end of each episode it kind of gets back to where it was at the beginning, and at the end of this you think, oh well, the characters have moved along a bit, but they've not moved that far, which actually brings me onto the characters. Like Waxillium, he does feel very much more like the unchanging hero type. We've got his like his origin story, like in which, but it's all backstory, you don't really care about that. There's this one thing that happens right at the beginning of the book, which I'm not going to spoil, which kind of sets up his emotional journey in this book, but he's much more of like a James Bond. Like James Bond, you don't really want him to change, and Sherlock Holmes and Captain Kirk and the guy from Firefly, I guess he has like an overarching character journey throughout the series, or maybe like Indiana Jones or something. Like he's pretty much set as a hero. He's set. All he's meant to be doing is doing the best thing. Like he's meant to do the right thing at the right time, save the girl, solve the mystery, shoot the bad guy. That's really what we want from this main guy. And then there's the cute cousin love interest. Her name is Marisi, and she's at quite a good balance between the damsel in distress and the very intelligent, very capable, too beautiful kind of perfect girl. I actually wanted her to be a little bit more active in the plot, but I think that if there's going to be a full series of these books, she could be a character which doesn't have to be a love interest. It's felt really obviously that she was going to be the love interest, and I think I might have spoiled it, but they don't actually get together by the end of the book, and it leaves it very open-ended. And I like that. I like it that there isn't... I mean, she was obviously... Like, as soon as she turned up, she was like, and the prospective wife turned up, and the cousin was there. And I'm like, well, the cousin's going to be the... Of course it's going to be the cousin. He's not going to do that. He's just going to... It's the cute cousin over there, the intelligent one who goes to university. But you can sort of see how that's setting up for more of a long-running thing. So that's a mild spoiler, but it doesn't mean much. But I do find that she brings out one of the worst points in the novel. And it's not her fault. It's just that this is how the world-building has been set up. There's a bit too much modern sociology, criminology, and you know, criminal theory, and you know, statistical analysis of crimes and stuff. Because she's a student, and she's all like, "Oh yes, well, out in the wilds, there's one policeman for every 500 people, and here in the city, the statistics show that there's only one policeman or one copper or Connor. I think they're called copper. Only one Connor per 5,000 people, and it feels a lot more dangerous out in the wilds. But actually, there's more murders here in the city, and it's not just that. At one point, she goes, "Now it." Over here, there's a reason why crime isn't going up there. You can be a policeman and do this, but actually there's this thing called the broken window theory. And I was like, really? Broken window theory? And again, I don't mind if an author wants to bring up like real world science or real world, you know, sociology, criminology, I don't know, or town planning. I'm not even quite sure what that is. But broken window theory is a very modern idea. And I don't think, you know, I don't even think a city could have been old enough, you know, 100 years ago, technologically, or maybe it would have been old enough to have broken theories, but the trying to work out the crime and actually working out the broken window theory relies on us knowing, you know, all of the kind of, like, industrial sector decline area and losses of jobs. So in a booming industrial revolution kind of city, the broken window theory isn't what you're worrying about. It's slums. Slums are what you're worrying about. Not that an area has been nice and is now declining and there's broken windows. What you actually, you haven't even got the nice areas yet, or they're still being built. So it felt too early. And if they'd have said, oh, there's this thing and it's called no pavement theory. It's like, if we put pavements in, people, there's less crime, or maybe a cracked pavement. So if it's a cracked pavement theory rather than a broken window theory, it felt a bit too modern. Anyway, bringing me on to my, I think one of my favourite characters is Wayne, and Wayne is the comic relief sidekick character. He is an ex-robber, and now he's not a robber anymore. He's a bad guy turned good. He now trades stuff. So when he steals something, he leaves something in its place, and there are some very valuable metals in here. So, but they're new metals. So when he steals something, he'll put a bit of this metal in its place, and the other person probably doesn't know how valuable it is. But it's an interesting little quirk that he has, and he doesn't shoot people; he fights with sticks, which is his special weapon. And he's very good at disguises because he can set up a bubble around himself and do stuff really quickly. One of the things that he does is actually get changed. He has all these disguises with him. He's got his fake mustaches and wigs and what else? Yeah, all these different clothes and these different things. He's got lots of different accents and he puts on different characters. So from one like step to another, like he can, you know, you do the quick change thing where you walk behind a lamppost and you go in one set of clothes and then come out with another set of clothes. That's it. Which is, you know, great, and it makes for some very interesting plotting, very interesting action, where he can take on both sides, almost take on two sides of an argument. He can do something and run away, and then when people catch up to him, you know, because nobody knows who he is, and he can use that to his advantage. And that's an interesting thing. But what I really enjoyed about it is that we start the book and it's all in Waxillium's point of view, but then we go off into Wayne and Marisi, and also into the bad guy's point of view as well, one of the main villains' point of view too. And one thing that I really enjoyed was that he starts acting like somebody, but then you start hearing the thoughts of the person that he's acting. He's playing this police officer. He's dressed up as a police officer, and because he's stolen a police officer's uniform, probably traded it somehow. And he comes in and he's like, oh, the person I've got to talk to actually, he's one rank higher than me, and he's 3 years younger than me as well. And I've been at this job for 20 years. And you start going into the internal monologue, not of Wayne in the situation as someone who's impersonating somebody else, but actually into the mindset of the person he is impersonating. And I thought that was some of my favorite parts. But Sanderson, he touches on them, and then that's it, and they go again. I was like, oh man, I want to read a whole novel like this. Just imagine reading a whole novel of somebody pretending to be a different series of like other characters, and you never actually see it from the point of view of the person who is pretending to be the character. It's just his actor's mindset, him putting himself into the mindset of another people, and you only ever get that second level whenever he's in character, and it's probably been done before, but it just, that kind of I don't think I've ever read it, maybe I should write it myself, but that little idea there, and I'm sure that in the book it's in italics or something, but with the audiobook it just sort of like just put on a slightly different voice. And the final character that we, as a viewpoint character, is the villain, and I actually thought he was quite interesting. Not great, but I liked how the villain in this book had the same mindset as the hero in the first Mistborn book, kind of, if not in not exactly the same, but there seems to be like an intentional analogy there between the aims and the role of the bad guy in this novel and the good guy in Mistborn. Maybe that's me just reading too much into it, but it's interesting there. What else do I do here? Magic. I kind of touched on that all before. There's another bit, the religions. It's like, is it real? Is it not? Does it exist? And there's hints that the religion in the background might be real, but again, that's not very well explored here. Again, maybe I probably need to read more into the, finish off the Mistborn trilogy, the second two books there, because I reckon that a lot of the more religious points of this book referencing on things that I kind of skipped in that thing. The writing is pretty good most of the way through. There's lots of action, blow by blow action sequences. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a sore throat. I'm just gonna take a drink. So there's lots of interesting weapons and tactics, and you're never not quite sure what the good guys are planning, because they kind of do things without thinking, and you're never sure what the bad guys are going to do either. So there's lots of surprises as you go through. In this novel as well, the tone is very light. There's very little of spending long times in people's heads, which is another thing that I dislike about Brandon Sanderson's books, especially his young male characters and his young female characters. I think so. We're just like young female and, you know, young girls and young boys who are doing this kind of stuff, then their feelings towards each other, not really that complex. Just get on with it. You don't have to spend chapters and chapters mulling over stuff in their brain. You know, write an action sequence where they decide to do something, or write an action sequence where their indecision means something, rather than just talking about their decisions or indecisions that they're trying to make in their head. Thankfully, this book is much more of the latter. It's sort of like people deciding stuff in the process of doing it, rather than lots of internal monologues. However, the light tone is, thankfully, there's not too much of this, but the jokes. Brandon Sanderson's characters, when they talk to each other, they always make, he thinks this witty dialogue, and I've noted it before that his witty dialogue just means if a pun is possible that somebody else has said, or if it's possible that someone says something with two meanings, go with the wrong meaning, or if they have a figure of speech, take the figure of speech literally and then make a joke. I might have mentioned this before in previous Brandon Sanderson reviews that I've done, but like it started off right at the beginning where two characters are talking, they're like in an action sequence, and then, you know, they're obviously a couple. One of them goes, "Cover me." And the other one says, "What? In dust? In kisses?" And it's like, "No, cover me. You know what? Cover me." And then, so, like, a bit later, it's like, "Am I suitable?" And it's like, "Yes, you are wearing a suit." And I'm like, "Ugh." Another says, "Don't ask her to pass the milk, because she'll throw a cow at you to make sure she gets the job done properly." And I'm like, "Don't pass the milk. Oh, don't." And then it's like, "What are you up to?" "Oh, about 170 pounds. It's like, "Great, thanks a lot for that." Thankfully, like about a quarter of the way into the book, I think Brandon Sanderson forgot about this witty dialogue technique, and then there's none of it, like, for the rest of the book, and I was like, "Oh, thank goodness." Or maybe if there was, it all just disappeared. However, there was still a bit of, like, the lazy writing. It's like when someone does something strange, and you're like, "Well, how would a normal person react to that?" He just has one of the characters go, "Well, I'm not going to respond to that," or "I have no way to respond to that," or "I don't know how to," you know. And it's just like, don't write about people saying that they're not going to respond to something. And then they even says, "I'm not going to respond to that." "Well, in fact, you have just responded by not saying," and it's like, "Oh, come on, just do that." What's the other note? Because I make notes about writing as I go through, so these are actually examples from the book. Oh, and the swearing. Rust and ruin. That's the, you know, I did a big rant in Way of Kings about storm as a bad swear word. Rust and ruin actually works as a swear word because it's not used very often. And when it does, it comes across much more of the kind of old Victorian / Wild West kind of swearing. Like, instead of it being like a substitute for, like, you know, "fuck off," like "rust off" or something, like "storm off," that's what it was in The Way of Kings. It's much more of a, like, "Oh, god darn it," or "gar jiminy," you know, that kind of, like, oh you, and it felt much more cartoony when someone says "rust and ruin" here, rather than it being a substitute for swear words which are actually vulgar or explicit. This is much more of a kind of thing, which makes it a lot more bearable. The narrator is Michael Kramer. Good job. Variable accents with some of them, especially Wayne. Like, you never. But then I think the point of Wayne is that you're never quite sure what his real accent is, because he was always taking on accents of other people and always doing impressions. But when he actually did a Wayne voice, I was like, was that the same? Is that the neutral Wayne voice? So I was never quite sure. Maybe it's just because he didn't have enough time to settle into Wayne's voice before he went off and kept returning back to it. But each time he returned back to Wayne's quote, own, quote, voice, unquote, voice, quote, yeah. Little bit of a problem. Finally, to come onto the themes of the book, you might not think there's a lot of depth in a book like this, but there's actually quite a lot of depth. Really, what this book is about is it's like this in-depth exploration into, woo, bang, bang, boom, kabow, boom, bang,
Are you okay? Yeah, you get the girl. I'll get the. You get the. Okay, you get the girl. I'll get the. Boom. Slow motion. Back to real time. Boom. So here's the train schedule, and I think the bad guys are going to attack around our. You'll never kill me, Waxillium. Thanks for saving me, Waxillium. I'll do anything that you. No time for that. Get to the chopper. Okay. Fire in the hole.
Yeah, so that kind of wraps up the themes of the book. I think I've covered everything there. So I'm going to give this book 5 stars because it's really good fun. Like I say, it's totally different. Like, don't go into this expecting epic fantasy, but if you want a really light read, you probably don't need to have read Mistborn before. Like I say, I only read the first book, and the magic is actually a lot more restricted, like I said. So there's not a lot to really worry about. Just think that you're going into, like, Wild West hero brought into the city, bit Sherlock Holmesy, bit Indiana Jonesy, bit James Bond kind of thing going on there. Again, not so much the characters of these people, more of the roles that they play in the story. If that's the kind of thing you want, fun adventure, layers of mystery and intrigue and train robberies, go for it. It's a lot of fun. 4 stars. That's it. So thanks a lot for listening to this this review. Email me luke@juggler.net if you've got any thoughts or anything like that. Follow me on goodreads.com, check out my reviews there, and there's even a SFBRP listeners group on there too. I was thinking about setting one up on Facebook, but in case anyone wants to chat there and actually get in contact with people more or other listeners in a more personal way rather than just on goodreads.com, which is always much more about the books. I might set that up in the future. Email me or even add me on Facebook if you're interested in being invited to a group like that, or if you're interested in me setting up, that might be good fun too. Otherwise, you follow me on Twitter and check out my blog, lukeburge.com/blog, or lukeburge.com for all of my writing and photography and music and essays and all of that other kind of stuff too. That's it for now. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.